It's 6 after 10. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Encyclopedia of Life is a free online collaborative encyclopedia intended to document all of the 1.8 million known species of living organisms known to science. That is what Wikipedia has to say about the Encyclopedia of Life. We're going to find out what some of the people who actually put this together have to say about it this hour, and we'll take your calls as well. I'm sure you're going to have lots of questions. You can start calling right now. We're going to have two different guests, one between now and 10:30, and then another one at 10:30 this morning. 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number anywhere that you can hear this, at least in the United States, and I think Canada. We know it doesn't work in Australia. 227-2050 is the number to use if you're calling us from Milwaukee. 800-486-8655, 227-2050. First, we're going to welcome to the program John McCarter, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Field Museum and a member of the Encyclopedia of Life Steering Committee. Good morning, sir, and thank you for spending some time with us today.
Happy to do it.
Where did the idea for the Encyclopedia of Life come from?
Back in the 1990s, there was a group of individuals in California, many of whom came out of the dot-com world, who started to talk with scientists about the lack of understanding of the complexity of the world and wondered about an online encyclopedia. Well, the idea got started and then was stopped and then was reinvigorated with a conversation between Ed Wilson, E.O. Wilson, the biologist from Harvard University, and Jonathan Fanton, the president of the MacArthur Foundation in Chicago. And the question was, would it be appropriate to get going on this again? And the confluence of support from the MacArthur and Sloan Foundations and the ability of the technological advances that have developed over the course of the last decade made it appropriate to give this another shot. So a year ago, right now, at the TED conference in Monterey, Technology, Entertainment, and Design Conference, Ed Wilson made a wish that an Encyclopedia of Life could be developed. And from that beginning, we then in May made an announcement of the Encyclopedia of Life. But the group of us that is involved has been working over the course of the last 2.5 or 3 years on putting this together in a way that we feel can be enormously positive for the study of science, both the serious postdoctoral scientists at Madison, University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the sixth grader up in Kenosha. So it's a very exciting project, and those of us who are involved are delighted to be part of it.
What were the technological limitations that prevented this from happening earlier? What's changed about the technology that makes it possible to do now?
Well, the enormous, as you see, the enormous scanning ability that where we are able to go into the internet and identify key words, for example, the name of a species like a leopard or a cheetah. Putting that and putting the scanners to work on finding where those words are mentioned in the World Wide Web. And then secondly, the scanning of all of the major natural history libraries, the scanning technology has improved in speed and in accuracy. So both from the printed word as well as from the virtual word, we now are able to scan and bring all of this information together. The other aspect of it, of course, is speed, and along with that is the reduction in cost.
Speaking of cost, what will this project cost? Well, you really, it will never be completed because you'll always be adding to it, but let's just say, for what you know about now, what is this going to cost?
The official estimate is that there are now someplace around 1,800,000 to 2 million named species. And the support from MacArthur and Sloan will together, MacArthur is $20 million, Sloan is $5 million, will provide about half of the resources that are necessary to do the first 5 years of this project. Each of us, representing what we call cornerstone institutions, is then responsible for the raising of an additional $5 million. So we think that for the first 5 years, this is a project that's going to cost something around or just north of $50 million. And with that, we're hopeful that we can do 1 million of the roughly 1.8 to 2 million species that have been identified to date. But you're very correct in saying, you know, this never gets done because the rate of scientific discovery continues. And as we get into the microbial world and into all of the additional species that are yet to be named, this will be an ongoing project for decades to come.
Now, this week you're unveiling the first 30,000 pages of the material that you have. And I'm not even sure pages is a really good word for this, but would it be 30,000 pages or 30,000 entries that could be numbers of pages?
I think the way I would characterize it is 30,000 pages representing these various species. And this is very much work in progress. What we want to do is to involve the public and the scientific community in building this with us. So a number of the pages that we have up now are strictly placeholders with the name of the species, with a photographic representation, with a Latin name in addition to the English name, and then some data that are available. But then, in addition, we've done a couple dozen pages in depth. So there we have been able, each of the institutions has scientists who have put together a really good first draft of what a particular species page and then links would look like. So hooked into the literature on a particular species, hooked into the biogeography, in some cases with some film, both still and running film. So to give a sense of what this ultimately will look like with this handful or couple dozen species pages, and then we have moved pages in from existing bases. So, for example, the ichthyologists have been working for 15 years or more developing a program called FishBase. So we've been able to move a number of the species over from FishBase and the images that are associated with those. So it's a good start. The folks at the Marine Biological Laboratory at Woods Hole in Massachusetts are leading the bioinformatics effort, and we went live yesterday, and now we're looking forward to continuing to build this.
Well, I hate to bring this up, but I've been trying to get into that website
right.
for the last 15 minutes, and I
yep.
haven't been able to yet.
Yep.
You must be getting an awful lot of traffic today.
Well, we did, and it went down, and then it was back up, and I'm sorry to say if you're unable to get into it, that apparently it's gone down again. There were millions of hits yesterday morning as this was announced, and apparently that's something that is common. It's all new to me, but when you have something that's of this popularity and attractiveness, the bloggers and all of the people who are on top of the technology immediately go to it and try to see what it is. So hopefully over the course of the next several hours we'll have it up again and available.
Well, I was able to get in yesterday and look around a little bit, and it was, I have to say, it was just fascinating. One of the things I know that was a goal of this was to make the information accessible to everyone. It's not just material that only scientists would find interesting or could understand. Do you have a bunch of writers who write material or who compose this material and try and keep it as accessible as possible, or how is that accomplished?
Well, the basic pages are the responsibility of what we call curators, who are the scientists who are involved. But they then are working with writers and communicators to simplify and make much more direct the communication. But ultimately, it's the responsibility of the curator of an individual page. And what we're trying to do is clearly not to make just a matter for the scientific community. We want those sixth graders. And we see now, at the time that kids are spending more and more time online and on computer games, et cetera, you know, what are they going to fill their time with? Well, here is science at their fingertips. And this is going to be valid around the world, from Nigeria to Peru to Wisconsin, providing a leveling of the playing field, or as you might say, you know, the flat world, of enabling access to scientific information, and also providing the opportunity for kids who are lovers of nature, who find a cardinal in the backyard, to add that image to the Encyclopedia of Life as their own personalized My Encyclopedia of Life. So we hope that this will be very broadly used, and as you can tell from your comment about going down right off the bat, this is a very popular site.
The phone number to call to get into this program, which is available and isn't down, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. If you're in Milwaukee, you can reach us at 227-2050, 414-227-2050. The topic under consideration this hour is the Encyclopedia of Life. It's a new online encyclopedia that will eventually catalog every species of life on the planet. That's the goal. And they have part of it done, and they're continuing to work on it. A whole bunch of people are working on this project and making use of all the new online technologies. It's really quite exciting. You can join us and chat about this this issue. What would you like to, I mean, what would be attractive to you about a website like this? Maybe you're in the education profession. Maybe you're a student. Maybe you're a researcher. Maybe you're just like me. You're something of a science geek, and something like this sounds pretty fascinating. 800-486-8655 and 227-2050 are the numbers. This half hour, my guest is John McCarter, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Field Museum and a member of the Encyclopedia of Life Steering Committee. Joining me after 10:30 will be Graham Higley, Head of Library and Information Services at the Natural History Museum of London, England, and he's also a member of the Encyclopedia of Life Steering Committee. I'm not a member of any steering committee. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 20 minutes past 10 o'clock, you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's coming up a little bit later on the Ideas Network. After one, on Talk of the Nation, NPR's political junkie sizes up the debates, the ads, the promises, the challenges, and the next primaries. That's after 1 o'clock this afternoon here on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's the Encyclopedia of Life, and we have with us to help describe this new venture on the World Wide Web, John McCarter, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Field Museum and a member of the Encyclopedia of Life Steering Committee. 800-486-8655 and 227-2050 are the numbers to call to join our program. Feel free to call in. I believe that there's still a line open that you can get in on, and we'll be taking calls shortly. I wanted to, first of all, though, before we go to the phones, I wanted to just ask you to compare the Encyclopedia of Life to, say, Wikipedia, which has become something of it's been become very popular. I know with talk show researchers, it's a great resource to have. But compare what you're doing to Wikipedia.
Well, Wikipedia is, in a lot of ways, the model and the inspiration. What the Wikipedia people have been able to accomplish is just truly astounding, both from a technological perspective, but then also from utilization. And the we met with them again yesterday. We probably had five or six meetings with people from Wikipedia and Wikimedia. This is different in that it is first of all, focused just on the species. So you can't go to us for the Baltimore Orioles baseball team. You can go to us for the Baltimore Oriole. We plan that this will be much richer in terms of images and in terms of the depth of the entries. So that as you go to a particular, you mentioned earlier, the raptors of Wisconsin, if you went to a species of raptor, you could be able to look at the migratory patterns, at the genealogy of the evolution of the species. You'd be able to identify what it eats and what eats it, its life cycle, the degree to which it is threatened as a species. And we would have with the images and the film, as well as all of the scientific papers accessible on the particular raptor that you would be concerned with. So it's a much more in-depth and a much more focused version of an online encyclopedia. But again, Wikipedia has led the way in this whole world of online communication and involvement of the public.
Well, and the public can get as much or as little detail as they want in each entry. I understand there's some sort of sliding button that you can manipulate to decide how far in you want to drill.
Yep, and it goes all the way from the novice at one extreme right on over to the expert who's the in one example the curator of the page. So we want to make this broadly accessible and. The scientific community is enormously excited about this, and I am too from that perspective, but the real power of this is public education and the impact. We get concerned about the degree of scientific illiteracy among our kids who are who get turned off for whatever reason about science, and this will be a wonderful opportunity for a re-engagement or an engagement both of the teachers but then also of the kids in having something available like this.
We have some callers who want to join us, and I should let them because that's what I get paid to do. Here's a call first. We'll go to Todd in Wisconsin Rapids.
Good morning.
Good morning, Todd. Thanks for calling.
I caught the tail end of this on one of the major networks this morning. And I multitask. And I was just catching part of your program while I was out taking care of things here on the farm. I saw a thing this morning about they just unearthed a fossil that you were talking about the history of life. Is that correct?
Yes.
What about this fossil that they just found up in the Arctic? It looks like it's got a head of an alligator. And the body of a fish.
Right.
And a head that looks like, or a neck that looks like it came from an ostrich. Now, I know that birds are what's left over from the dinosaurs. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. Do you have any more information on that?
Sure.
I found that fascinating.
Well, I'm glad that you did. The individual who led the team who discovered that is the provost of the Field Museum in Chicago, and also a professor at the University of Chicago. His name is Neil Shubin, S-H-U-B-I-N, and the animal that you're referring to is one that lived 350 million years ago. The location was up in Ellesmere Island in the north of Canada, and you're absolutely right. This is a fish. It has scales, it has fins, but in addition, it has an articulated neck, so that rather than the solid body of a fish, it is able to look up and down and to the side. In addition, it has lungs that are built into the gills, the beginning of lungs. It also, in the fins, has the digits of the fingers that we now have, the five fingers, and the complex of wrist bones and the arm bones. And so this is a wonderful example of a transitional link between fish, then moving out of the sea onto land. So the Tiktaalik is the name of it. And in addition, Neil has just published a book called Your Inner Fish. That's Neil, S-H-U-B-I-N, S-H-U-B-I-N, Neil Shubin. It's currently number 20 on the New York Times bestseller list and has been translated into a dozen languages already. But that's exactly the kind of information that we will embed in the Encyclopedia of Life on the subject, in this case, of fish evolution.
And Larry Mueller of Wisconsin Public Radio just did a show about that book, I believe.
Good.
Recently. So our listeners should already be familiar with it. Todd, thanks for that call. Let's take another call quickly from Gene in Milwaukee. Gene, good morning. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I'm calling because when I was a little girl, I drove my grandmother nuts by asking her a lot of questions about life. And she said to me, oh, well, you'll find all that in the Book of Life, Gene. So I went to the library as a little child, and I asked the librarian for the Book of Life. I'm so glad now that it's finally out.
Well, we're delighted that we've been able to scratch this long-standing itch that you've had.
It's pretty long-standing, but thank you for doing all the work.
Thank you.
Gene, thanks for the call. I had to satisfy myself with the Time Life series and All About books. I think those were published by Random House, if I'm not mistaken. God, the fact that I can remember that is it really labels me as a complete geek.
Good. Geeks are good.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that. There's hope for me yet. This obviously, everybody who's involved with this is incredibly excited about it. A lot of hard work has gone into it. I don't know if this is a question that can be answered or not. I'll leave that to you. But how many people have had a piece of this thing so far, have worked together to make this happen?
Oh, probably a couple hundred already. At the institutional level, it's a joint venture. The Field Museum in Chicago, Field Museum of Natural History, Harvard University, the Marine Biological Laboratory at Woods Hole, the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, the Missouri Botanic Garden. And so at each of those institutions, which we call cornerstone institutions, we've had dozens of people involved. So it's been quite an effort already.
And an international effort, too, as our next guest will tell us. But first, I want to thank John McCarter for joining us for this half hour. Really appreciate your time, and congratulations to you and the entire steering committee and everyone else who has had anything to do with this thing to get this off the ground. Wonderful achievement.
Well, thank you. Good to be with you.
John McCarter is President and Chief Executive Officer of the Field Museum in Chicago and a member of the Encyclopedia of Life Steering Committee. Joining us now by telephone is Graham Higley, Head of Library and Information Services at the Natural History Museum in London, England, and he is also a member of the Encyclopedia of Life Steering Committee, and he joins us by telephone. Good morning, sir, and thank you for spending some time with us today.
Good morning, John.
Well, we've been talking about this for about 20 minutes, and we would need hundreds and hundreds of minutes and hours and everything to get through all the things that I would like to talk about concerning this, and our listeners want to join us, too. I want to just take a moment before we begin our conversation with you to mention the phone numbers again, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's a local call, and you can get us at 414-227-2050, 227-2050. The Encyclopedia of Life, a tremendous collaboration and something that appears to not have an end. I mean, it seems like there'll always be something else to something new to discover in the world of biology and life. Has got to be really exciting for everybody who's involved in library or information services, something on this scale.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, our initial project will run for, we think, about 10 years, and that will, as it were, collect all the data on everything we know about now. But there are somewhere in the region of 10,000 new species being discovered every year, and so those will be added to the encyclopedia going forward. One of the key things for us is going to be not running this as a one-off project leading to a book like the Encyclopedia Britannica, but for it to be a continuously growing database, which means that we need to develop long-term funding, which keeps this going into infinity, really.
Well, just every time you turn around, we're discovering something new. As you mentioned, 10,000 species uncovered every year. The more we find out about our planet, the more we know that we don't know, evidently. It's always fascinating to view all the new discoveries. One of the things that as I was researching this project in preparation for this morning's program, is I discovered that the ranks of what are called taxonomists, the scientists who describe species and revise descriptions, the numbers of people in that field seem to be shrinking. Will a project like this, you think, cause those numbers to go back the other way?
Well, I think there will be a major change. The profession of taxonomist, the kind of scientist who catalogues life, is a traditional Western museum-based role with a formal science training. We think that as we're effectively repatriating all the information in the encyclopedia to the developing world as well as it being useful here in the West, that means that ultimately an awful lot of that taxonomic work, the field work, the investigation, the looking in the field and naming of new species will be done by people in what are currently developing countries, in Brazil, in India, in China, in Indonesia, rather than the current model, which is that white guys from our museums go to their countries and mooch around for a couple of days and then come back.
What about species that are dying off or who that have become extinct? Are they included in this encyclopedia?
Yeah, we had to set an arbitrary date at some time in the past. So we're including anything in that's died out in the last 500 years. So the dodo will be in eventually, for instance.
Well, that's a great relief.
But we're not going back prehistoric. At the moment, we're not planning to be doing the dinosaurs.
We've heard news reports about how excited the scientific community is, and I think the general public must have been pretty excited about this. I understand that the website initially yesterday had over 1 million hits, which is that's an incredible number of people who have been trying to look at what's on your encyclopedia. That has to be very gratifying in a way to know that so many people are interested in what you've accomplished.
Yes, it's very interesting because we had a dinner with some colleagues here in San Francisco, a little celebration last night, and there were a number of people from the IT industry present, and their view was that it was a sign of success to have crashed our website, whereas we'd spent most of the day worrying about it. They said, no, that's a good sign. We definitely did get a much bigger response from the public than we expected, and that is great.
Why do you think that was? I mean, why was that response so great? Why are people so interested in this?
I think there are a number of reasons. I think there's always been a general wide-ranging interest in plants and animals. You look at the biggest societies in our respective countries, they're things like bird watchers. There's a lot of inherent interest that's been there a long time. But I also think that in the last few years, a consciousness of climate change, of biodiversity loss, plants and animals becoming extinct, has raised the visibility of those issues, and therefore the broad interest has moved away from the cuddly animals and moved much more to looking at the whole of life on this planet, and a lot more people are getting that message.
I'm just wondering if there isn't something to the idea that we're delivering this information using the most current technology. If you ask someone to pick up a book that was full of descriptions of various types of life, that it might not be as exciting as if you ask them to go to a website. Do you suppose there could be some of that here too?
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. I mean, there's a very famous collective work which lists all the species that were known in Central America in 1900. It's got about 70,000 species listed. It's 65 volumes with 300 pages in each volume. So it's absolutely huge. But in reality, people want to know about what they're interested in, so they'll be interested in the birds of Costa Rica. So much more focused. And you can't really do that with a paper publication. You can only do that with a database and a website.
We have some people who want to join us by phone and ask questions or make a comment about this. You can, too. There's still a line open, 800-486-8655, 227-2050. If you are in Milwaukee, I'll repeat them again more slowly this time, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. If you're calling us from Milwaukee, please use our local number. That's 414-227-2050. The topic this hour is the newly published online Encyclopedia of Life. It's quite an exciting project, and it's going to keep getting bigger and bigger as it grows and as various people contribute to it. And we're talking about that this hour, and you can join us as well. And we will take your calls as they come in. As I said, there's still a line open for you if you want to join us now, so please do so at 800-486-8655 or 227-2050. What do you think about this? Is this something you're excited about? Is this you plan on visiting the site once it's back up? It attracted so much attention yesterday that all of us internet users crashed it, which IT professionals said that was a good sign. And they hope to have the site back up again within a little bit, so you can go look at it too. By the way, in case you missed the URL for the site, it's www.eol, for Encyclopedia of Life, .org. And we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll go to the phones, and we'll have more of our conversation with Graham Higley, who's head of Library and Information Services at the Natural History Museum in London, England, and a member of the Encyclopedia of Life Steering Committee. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 20 minutes before 11 o'clock. Speaking of 11 o'clock, after 11, what happens when a hawk or eagle is injured? Antigo Raptor Rehabilitator Marge Gibson is Larry Mueller's guest after 11. She'll talk about the process of restoring an injured bird to fly again. That's after 11 this morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, the topic is the Encyclopedia of Life, the new online encyclopedia that is attempting to catalog all the species of life on planet Earth. It's a huge undertaking, with some 1.8 million species known so far and more being discovered every year. This promises to be a project which will continue to grow and grow over the years. And we've had two different guests on this hour and with us right now to help us understand what this new encyclopedia is all about and give us an idea of the scope of the project and answer your questions. We have Graham Higley, head of Library and Information Services at the Natural History Museum in London, England, and a member of the Encyclopedia of Life Steering Committee. He's joining us by phone, and you can too at 800-486-8655. And before we go to the phones, I want to give the website for the Encyclopedia of Life Project one more time, and I'll hopefully remember to do it at the end of the broadcast as well. www.eol.org. And if you try to get into it right now, you won't, because the site crashed. So many people wanted to see it, they crashed the server, and they're working hard to get that back up again, and I'm sure they'll have it up later today. And then you can go look at it. But for now, write this down, www.eol.org. Let's go to the phones and take a call from Dave in West Salem. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. Hello, Dr. Higley.
Good morning.
See, my question, really, I wanted to tell you, I have a daughter who's a junior in high school, and she's been kind of drifting away from some of the things that we enjoyed when she was growing up, the sciences. She's been really excited about the Encyclopedia of Life, and we'd got an announcement yesterday on the internet that it was opening, And it's just fun to see this interest in learning that this is helping to kindle or rekindle in her. As for myself, I'm just wondering, sometimes I get thrown by taxonomists, and I'm wondering about Culicida, I'm wondering about mosquitoes, what kind of taxonomic guides you may have in the encyclopedia. And the other thing I'm wondering is why, sometimes taxonomists drive me a little crazy. You find things like mosquitoes, Ochla rotatus, and Aedes. You have species like Triceratus and Hendersoni that are so closely related. They alter the name Ochla rotatus from Aedes for one, but not for the other. Can you give me a clue on why that happens?
Yeah, sure. Can I just say that your daughter is certainly one of our major target audiences. We are going to be developing a whole range of education-based tools to sit on top of the encyclopedia to enable it to be used very actively in school and home environments. Coming to the mosquito question, I think one of the interesting things in taxonomy, particularly in the insects, is that so many insects look pretty much the same, and traditional methods of separating them have been entirely visual, and that's turned out to be not a very good solution. And as we do more and more DNA work, it's become clear that species that we thought were single have turned out to be multiple. And in some cases, species where we thought there were two or three species, when you do the DNA work, you find they're all variants on the same animal. And so one of the things we're going to be attaching to the Encyclopedia of Life site is the DNA sequences for when they become known for all the animals and plants that we represent in the encyclopedia. Because this is an interesting and developing area. A lot of things that people thought they knew are not turning out to be exactly right when you do the DNA work.
Well, thank you very much. And I knew that with some of the Culex species that they were seeing that. And I'm so happy that you answered that for me, because these species are not only very similar when you're looking at the taxonomy, but in life cycle and location, one's high, one low.
Yep.
So. Well, thanks so much.
Great.
Dave, thanks for the call. And I just want to comment, only on public radio would you get callers who would be able to speak Latin. Let's go next to Frank in Madison.
Hello.
Frank, good morning.
I was one of the people who wasn't able to log on, and your guest has partially answered one of my questions. But do you anticipate that we're going to go back to taxonomy being a semi-amateur discipline as it was in the 19th century? The beetle collectors are going to have a higher status?
Yeah, I wouldn't use the term amateur, because certainly in the UK, I can tell you that for Diptera, there is nobody in the universities or our museum who knows more than the people in the Diptera Society. They are the best people for identifying Diptera, which are just ordinary black flies, by the way, in the UK. And I'm sure that's true worldwide. There are not enough scientists to go around to do every species, and there are many, many people with real skills of identification and scientific analysis who don't do it professionally, who have kind of a contribution to make, which is at least as important as the scientists.
And the second question is, do you anticipate integrating the DNA barcode project with this site? And to what degree is continuity going to be assured in that? I think there were preceding projects, the Tree of Life project and the Linnaeus project.
Yeah. On the Barcode of Life project, yes, they're an active partner, and we will rip from one site to another, as it were, and we will be acting as a focal point for people who want to find out whether a species has a barcode or not, and then go off to the barcode of life site. Sustainability and keeping this running long-term is one of our major concerns at the moment. It's been relatively easy to find money to get the project up and running and to go for that target of 1.8 million species. But we think it's absolutely critical that there is long-term sustainable money which will keep us going long into the future. And that will be a major issue for us. And we're looking at a number of different ways of putting that consistent financial base in place. The problem with previous projects is that they have been projects, and then when the money runs out, the project stops. It sits on the web and it withers, really.
Well, that's so common, not just as scientific projects, but it's not necessarily easy, but it seems to be a lot easier to get something going. Foundations don't like to support continuing projects. They like to get things started and then, well, go find your money somewhere else. And that's always a problem when you're trying to do something like this.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But in this particular case, we have some of the biggest institutions on the planet in the biodiversity area engage. So we think there are ways of making this happen and that we've got a much better chance of long-term survival than many of the previous projects.
Give me an idea of what all the money goes for. I mean, something on this scale, I mean, we look at it on the web and we see some pictures and some text and so forth, but there's a tremendous amount of work that goes into this. What does the money allow you to do?
Okay, well, there are a number of different areas of work involved. One is the informatics activity, which is led by the Marine Biological Laboratory at Woods Hole, and that's basically building the website and building it out so it connects with lots of other partner institutions. We're not holding all the data in one location, so it's critical that we have appropriate links to lots and lots of partners. And that's quite a complex task. It's a big site already. It is growing. It will be more complex in the future. So the informatics piece is a big chunk of money at the moment. The other large area of expenditure at the moment is the Biodiversity Heritage Library component, which actually I'm chair of. The BHL is a consortium of 10 natural history libraries, which is planning to scan all the natural history literature which is not in copyright and make it freely available on the web. And that will be linked to the individual species pages. So the literature references to a particular mosquito, as that gentleman was asking about earlier, the literature that was published will be linked to that page. So people can actually go back to the old journal publications, the old monographs from the site. And that's an expensive process, 10 cents a page, and we're looking probably at somewhere in the region of 100 million pages altogether. And that will take a big chunk of the money. We're also doing a lot of work, and that will start at the back end of this year, on the education front, where we're developing toolkits for educationalists and for societies to put their own skin or overlay on the site and use it for their own purposes, for teaching in schools, teaching in universities, or for perhaps a bird watching society in Arkansas to put their own skin on the site and limit to their own sets of species that they're interested in. And that is another piece of IT, but it's also much more importantly a lot of customer focused work where we'll be talking to potential users and really understanding what they want to achieve in learning terms.
Well, I'm just, you can't see this on the radio, probably a good thing. I'm just shaking my head because I'm thinking the people who are in my generation have been witness to such an incredible shift, an acceleration in technology. And those of us who are, let's say, in our 50s will remember that it was considered a pretty big deal that each classroom had a set of encyclopedias in it. hasn't been all that long ago, and some of us were even getting some instruction via radio. And now, you know, classrooms have computers and teachers have access to so much more information that they can pass along to their students. It's really, it really is incredible.
Yeah, it is a dramatic change. And I think one of the things that we offer, and there are loads and loads of websites with species information on the web already, but the one thing that we think that we add, which is a specific additional value, is the fact that all of our species pages will be validated by an expert, whether that's a local expert, an amateur, a society, or a scientist. At least everything we publish will go through a vetting process, so it will be consistent and high quality.
The initial project is to gather up the currently available data on the known species that we have now. And you mentioned there are thousands of new species being discovered every year. How will those new species be incorporated as you go along? So some scientist discovers something. How does that discovery get into your encyclopedia?
Okay. Well, there will be a formal mechanism for that. There's some software which isn't visible on the site, but which is available to scientists, which enables them to go through a process of putting their new species information up. And actually, there's an example on the site now. There's a fish called Blue Chromis, which is one of the 25 exemplar pages which we have. Blue Chromis is a fascinating new fish discovered off Hawaii very recently and only described for the first time in January of this year. So that is a very, very new species, and literally it's up within 6 weeks of its initial description.
800-486-8655, toll free, or 227-2050. We have time to get in a couple more calls maybe before the top of the hour, so if you get on the phone very quickly, you can have a chance to ask a question of Graham Higley, who is head of Library Information Services at the Natural History Museum in London, England, and a member of the Encyclopedia of Life Steering Committee. And I hear the term steering committee. What did the steering committee do? What was your role in this project?
Essentially, we provide the kind of guidance for the way the project runs. We haven't set up a foundation or corporate institution or anything like that yet. We think we might go in that direction in a few years' time. But right at the moment, with the funding we got from the MacArthur Foundation and from Sloan Foundation, basically they wanted us to go very fast. And rather than spend a lot of time trying to sort out how we would run our business, we set up a very pragmatic solution, which is just a steering group. We don't have any kind of formal structures. We have all signed a memorandum of understanding, and we all want to go in the same direction.
I think we'll get in one quick call here, and in fact, I'm going to get ahead of the producers and just say, take whoever's on line one and let's get them on the air so they can ask their question. I believe the person is Jay on line one. Thank you for calling, Jay, and please be brief.
Okay, I grew up with two Siamese cats, which are really like Tonkinese cats. The umbrella term is Siamese cat. And then I'd go over to the zoo and see like the Siberian tigers and stuff, and it was a very interesting to me to research all how cats are domesticated over time, and there's a zillion types of different cats, but compared to the wild cats and like the zoo and all that. And I would still use this website because I would try to, whenever I see a friend that has a pet cat, I try to figure out what species it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, your question is an incredibly complex one, as it turns out. Cats and dogs are very unusual in that they have really tremendously different physical appearances, yet they are, in DNA terms, they are very, very similar. There's a huge difference between that Siberian tiger and your cat, but there's very little difference between your cat and the moggy next door to me or any of the domestic cats. This is due to the fact that just one or two small changes in the DNA will produce really different-looking animals. And we, the humans, have essentially bred for different looks in dogs and cats for thousands of years, and that's why we have so many, and why they can all interbreed, because actually they are all the same breed.
Wow, this is fascinating, and I could just listen to stuff programs about this for hours and hours, but we have to move along. Time is our master. Thank you so much for spending this half hour with us. I really appreciate it.
No problem at all, John. Thank you very much for having us on.
Graham Higley, Head of Library and Information Services at the Natural History Museum in London. The website is www.eol.org. Rhonda Fanning produced this program. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.